In October last year, Hurricane Sandy hit the northeast coast of America, causing devastation to much of New York. I'm Isabel Hilton, and I've been to New York to look at the lessons the city has learned from Sandy and how it might cope with future floods and storms. This is The Drowning City. If you stand here in Battery Park at the very tip of Manhattan, you get, amongst other things, a great view of New York Harbor and the Statue of Liberty. This is where New York's story began, but now it's facing an uncertain future. Just 4 months ago, after Hurricane Sandy ripped into New York, this park was under 10 feet of water. Sandy, combined with steadily rising sea levels, had a devastating effect. It killed more than 100 people along the coast, destroying houses, flooding streets and subways, and knocking out the power to over 8 million customers for days.
Some people died. Some people lost their property. Some people lost their businesses. People died at Breezy Point, where houses were overwhelmed, where houses burned. You know, some people didn't get out.
When you put entire Wall Street out of business for days, that's vulnerable. When you have schools over hundreds of square miles not operating, that's vulnerable. Cell communication was down, internet was down. People were killed because their trees came crashing down on their houses. That's very vulnerable.
Behind me, they haven't seen anything like this since the bombing of London after World War II. They are now calling this fire here in Breezy Point the worst fire in New York City history in terms of destruction.
ABC News was in Breezy Point riding out the fury of Sandy when the wind and the water gave way to this.
Oh my God.
That's fire.
Well, there's nowhere else to go.
Breezy Point is destroyed, it feels like. It's like the apocalypse.
There wasn't anything that you could refer to as panic, nor was there really a sense of chaos, but mostly just absolute shock at the degree of destruction.
When I went into Lower Manhattan the next evening, it was an incredibly surreal experience because the city was dark. It was black. There were no lights. And New York City is always so light. It was very scary and spooky and strange.
Almost one-third of all of Manhattan in total darkness, without electricity, and many buildings without running water, without elevator service, for many days. Hundreds of thousands of people having that horrific experience for a prolonged period of time. It was a very frightening, surreal experience.
One of the world's richest cities, crippled by a storm. At its height, Hurricane Sandy was 1,000 miles wide. It broke all the records for storm surges, wave heights and rainfall. And it just might have changed the minds of New Yorkers towards climate change forever. When it hit, it sparked a huge fire and smashed houses all along the exposed beaches. It also sent a 14-foot surge of water crashing into the New York Harbor. And it just kept going. I travelled to Albany to meet the seismologist Klaus Jacob as he surveyed his battered 19th century wooden house on the banks of the Hudson River, some 30 miles upstream from New York Harbour. He's a scientist, and because he officially predicted years ago that a big flood would come, he raised his own house a full 4 feet to fend it off. But when Sandy's flood came, that wasn't enough.
The water was driven into the New York Harbour and the Hudson empties normally itself out into the New York Harbor. In this case, it flushed backward. We had 9 feet of a storm surge. The storm surge does exactly what the tides do. It just runs up roughly with the speed of a very fast biker or a very slow car all the way up. So it takes some 5-6 hours for the tidal swell to arrive up in Albany. Here it arrived about an hour after it hit New York City.
So just coming in the front door of what looks pretty normal from the outside, we're suddenly in a scene of devastation here.
I'm fully aware that I will be probably either the last generation or last but one generation that will live in this house. You can raise this house farther and farther, but eventually you just won't get to it unless you come by motorboat. And the streets will be flooded all the time. If the infrastructure is not maintained, what's the point in living in the water on a dry little island that you call your home or house?
After Sandy, New Yorkers know that storms that were comfortably described as 100-year events could easily recur this year or next or in 5 years' time. The mood in Mayor Michael Bloomberg's city seems serious today, but will the memory of Sandy last long enough to translate into action? George Diodatis, professor of civil engineering from Columbia University, says decisions are urgent.
If nothing is done within the first year, the issue is forgotten. If decisions are made to strengthen the infrastructure in the next 6 months, these measures eventually are implemented. And so it's absolutely critical in this case to do something in the next 6 months.
But if scientists have been warning for several years that sea level rise threatened New York, why wasn't the city itself better prepared? Erwin Redliner, director of the National Center for Disaster Preparedness, spent a lot of his time watching the mounting hurricane threat along America's entire eastern seaboard, where more than 8 million people now live at risk from coastal flooding.
I think part of the reason that America is not prepared has to do with our cultural bias to the more immediate and really difficulty coping with long-term investments. 22% of America's children live in poverty right now. We don't seem to quite grasp that from a policy point of view, and it's similar to the fact that we really do have to strengthen our infrastructure if we're going to be more resilient to disasters in the future. Part of it's human nature, and part of it's lack of leadership, and part of it's a mystery, really.
The residents of the devastated community of the Rockaways trying to shame Republicans in Congress into voting their emergency funds. Congress has now voted some $50 billion to back up insurance claims. But the true cost of Sandy is closer to $70 billion, and that's just one storm. So what if it happens again? Malcolm Bowman, professor of oceanology at New York State University, thinks the city needs monumental sea defenses like those that protect Rotterdam or St. Petersburg. Looking out to sea in Battery Park, he describes his plans.
One would go to the Verrazano Narrows to the south of us, across the, under the Great Verrazano Bridge. Another one would be in the Upper East River, where the harbor joins Long Island Sound, another secondary source of surges. And a third one, the most interesting one to me, is what we call the Outer Harbor Gateway, further south between northern New Jersey and the tip of Long Island.
But that's a long way. That's a long barrier.
That's a 5 mile stretch, but the thing is the water is quite shallow there. It's 20 to 25 feet deep.
The buzzword from the mayor's office outwards is resilience. How to do it, though, is a bit more complicated. Giant seawalls would take 10 years to build, and first the city must decide how big and exactly where they should be. And even when they're built, not everyone is safe. Klaus Jacob and Malcolm Bowman. But first, George Diodatis.
These are going to cost a lot of money, probably something of the order of $20 to $30 billion. This is going to be federal funds. However, they will only protect a small percentage of the population in this area. Essentially, everyone who is in the inside of New York City Harbor, part of Manhattan, the inside of Staten Island, and then parts of Brooklyn and Queens. However, the communities that were mostly devastated during Hurricane Sandy will not be protected.
If New York City decides it's going to stand and fight and not run for the hills, eventually, by that maybe 200 years from now, all these islands, Manhattan Island, Staten Island, and all around New York City is going to have a big wall around it. You can't use what we see now. Everything will be flooded here. Some people say, well, we've got to start thinking about evacuating in the long term. Not in our lifetimes, but I say, well, I don't think that's unrealistic in a way, because you talk to the Dutch. You're going to tell them to run for the hills, and if the city can be made to last another 250, 300 years, no one can think past that.
There is a problem with barriers. Barriers are very good to keep storm surges out. But as sea level rises and you have to keep the barriers open to let the inland water out, You cannot keep sea level rise out. So the ultimate solution is to retreat to its higher ground that it has. Miami and New Orleans don't have that. We will have to move a little bit closer together on high ground and redesign our cities.
So if walls are not enough, could New Yorkers ever think the unthinkable and just give parts of the city back to the sea?
This is not going to be easy. There are people who have lived there for generations. They are emotionally attached. But this is a long-term solution. So if you open the discussion now with the community and you explain to them that the combination of the sea level rise with future hurricanes might make this destruction much more frequent, eventually you could convince them to move to a higher elevation.
The idea has its supporters. Ronald Schiffman is an urban planner who has no doubt that it would be cheaper for some people to move, not least because if they don't, they're going to be hit again and again. Parts of the Rockaways, for instance, a neighborhood that sits on a fragile spit of land north of New York Harbor, might just have to be abandoned.
For $50 million, we could buy out 80 or 90 of these families and move them someplace else, and then take that land and use it as marshland to protect some of the upland areas surrounding it. We've got to come up with these strategies. In every community, they'll be a little bit different. In some communities that are multi-story buildings, maybe the issue is to vacate only the first floors.
The Dutch have fended off the sea for centuries, and suddenly New York is keen to learn from their experience. Dutchman Jürgen Ertz, who's looking at what sea defences for New York would look like, doesn't believe people will ever volunteer to move.
When I look at the facts, everywhere around the world, every coastal city, nobody ever retreats from its home ground. On the contrary, waterfronts remain attractive. People want to live there, do business at the waterfront. People stay there. Look at New Orleans. People came back. No, I think the only option is to make those waterfronts more resilient, either by upgrading building codes, etc., or by protection. There will be more inhabitants and more new buildings in New York City the coming decades. It is projected that in the coming 30 years, there will be 1 million more inhabitants in New York City. And the majority of those people will live in the flood zone.
I'm Isabel Hilton, and you're listening to The Drowning City on the BBC World Service. One of New York's better busker groups sing their troubles in a reopened downtown subway station. Sandy flooded the subway lines and tunnels that are the city's nervous system. They're still painstakingly cleaning out the mud and salt from parts of it, and a brand new billion-dollar subway is still full of debris from the harbour. New York was paralysed, just as Klaus Jacob had predicted.
When we started to look what storm surges would do, it very quickly became clear that New York City is extraordinarily vulnerable. Even right now at the current sea level, which is about 1 foot higher than it was when, for instance, the subway started to be built in the year 1904, the first subway was opened. And since then, the sea level already has risen by 1 foot. It became very clear that the subway would flood within 40 minutes. And not only the subway would flood, many of the road tunnels that connect Manhattan to Brooklyn, Queens, to the Bronx, to New Jersey, underneath the Hudson River, all those would flood.
So what will happen down in Lower Manhattan, home to great global symbols like Wall Street and the New York Stock Exchange, not to mention the new World Trade Center? Susanna Drake, an urban landscape architect, thinks it's going to change forever.
We were really focusing on the area of Lower Manhattan below Chambers Street, actually below Canal Street. And in that zone, we could expect that 21% of that area would be flooded. And then if you had a storm surge, you could anticipate that over 60% of that area would be inundated, at least temporarily.
That 21% then is flooded permanently, is effectively underwater.
It's underwater, yes. It'd be a new landscape of Lower Manhattan unless we do something to prepare. You would lose all of Battery Park City, which is a very beautiful development in the city that went in actually on the fill excavated by the development of the World Trade Center. But it's interesting because Lower Manhattan has expanded a huge amount over the last 400 years. And so what we've done over the last 400 years is progressively fill out further into the harbor. And the land that we've filled in is actually the most vulnerable to these climate change impacts.
New York's mayor, Michael Bloomberg, has spoken out about preparing his city for climate change and done a lot to persuade his citizens, though not necessarily to foot the bill. The mayor has ordered an urgent report on how the city can best fortify its critical infrastructure, and that will be ready soon. Seth Pinsky is leading the task force, and he's in no doubt that radical changes will be needed.
If people's homes were elevated above the ground and their critical systems were elevated above the ground, there would be a much greater chance that those people would be able to weather storms. That's an example of not having necessarily to retreat from a place, but to change the way you live in a place.
When you look at future-proofing the city, how far ahead are you looking? Looking 2030, 2050, the end of the century?
The work that we're doing in the Bloomberg administration is focused on two periods of time. One is what we're referring to as the 2020s, the midterm, and the other is what we're referring to as the 2050s, the long term. The good news is that for the really dire impacts that climate change is likely to have, there is still time for the city to, in an evolutionary process, make the changes that it needs to make.
I'm not sure whether you're familiar with the so-called High Line in New York City, which is this wonderful raised park of an old railroad track. We will have many of those High Lines connecting downtown buildings, and we can walk from the one to the next and can look down on the water like in San Marco of Venice and see the ducks floating around. It will be a different cityscape. We have to rethink how we live with water rather than fight the water.
Back in 2010, New York's Museum of Modern Art was taking heed of scientists' warnings in its own way, exploring how the city might manage to live with its feet in the water. In a show called Rising Currents, MoMA invited engineers, architects, artists, ecologists, and landscape architects to come up with ideas on how New Yorkers might live in a warmer world. Proposals included restoring the city's natural defences to slow down storm surges by creating artificial islands and interlocking reefs, suspending houses over water, building new piers to deflect waves, or putting oyster beds into old shipping wharves to create marine parks. All ideas that the mayor's office will now be studying seriously. Susanna Drake argued for an ambitious green approach for the city's streets.
What we were proposing was to have the surface be made of a permeable concrete. So the concrete would have to have holes in it. It has to have apertures to allow the water to absorb into it. And then underneath that topping, that permeable topping, there would be other layers of absorbent material that could allow the water to then percolate down into the water table. So it's establishing more of the natural hydrology of the ground in what is a very disturbed urban soil condition.
Sandy revealed what many suspected, that New York's rickety infrastructure couldn't cope with the last storm, let alone what might come next. Here on the streets of Lower Manhattan, the noise and the fumes from the huge generators that are still powering several of these downtown buildings reminds us that a cleanup that includes toxic waste still goes on. Meanwhile, New York scientists agree that the seas will continue to rise, but they differ on how much and how fast. Estimates range from 3 to 12 feet. And New York, like other threatened coastal cities around the world, cities like Shanghai, Bangkok, Mumbai and Sydney, will all have to plan for these uncertainties. But will they move in time? I'm going to talk to Peter Miskovich, an advisor to several New York climate change initiatives.
I think we've reached a new threshold. The financial implications here are so great. And I think once that level of financial commitment is brought to the table, I think it's difficult to ignore the future. The question that I have is, will we do it quickly enough? Will we be prepared enough for the next event? And will we make wise decisions in terms of how we rebuild and how we reorganize? And I think those questions remain to be answered.
Let me stress that we are ordering this evacuation for the safety of the approximately 375,000 people who live in these areas. If you live in these areas, you should leave them this afternoon. Low-lying areas.
Mayor Bloomberg evacuating his citizens in the storm. Now he has to work out how to protect his city from the rising seas and how to pay for it. In 1991, here in New York, the 9/11 attacks led the whole nation to rethink its security. Government was redrawn and Homeland Security was created to meet the threat. In the wake of Hurricane Sandy, many are calling for another rethink. But so far, it seems unlikely that even this disaster will move the government. So now, it's the cities that are facing up to the threat. And cities around the world are talking to each other about how to protect themselves. In New York, every foot of sea level rise will put another 100,000 people at risk. For many people, climate change still seems like a distant threat. In New York, it suddenly seems rather close, no longer an abstract future prospect, but an urgent reality. Erwin Redliner and Klaus Jacob think the message of Sandy is inescapable.
These are questions that every country on the planet, and certainly every coastal city on the planet, is going to have to face now. Even if we did everything we needed to do tomorrow for slowing climate change and global warming, we're still going to be facing sea level rises, for example, for maybe 200 years. For New York, I'm very worried that, in fact, we won't do what needs to be done right now. Politicians will say, yeah, we'd like to do that, but we simply can't afford it. To which, of course, the response is, can we afford not to?
For cities that are at or below sea level, I'm afraid New York has little to offer because they are, in my mind, eventually doomed. I don't think that cities like Miami or, for that matter, even Rotterdam and to some degree London have the ability to keep the water out forever. Either you live with the water or you leave. It's the one or the other.
I'm Isabel Hilton. You've been listening to The Drowning City. It was produced by Anthony Denslow and was a Whistledown production for the BBC World Service.